Welcome to the Drummer Podcast from the Ruffed Grouse Society, in association with the American Woodcock Society. Now your host.
I'm Matt Solberg, RGS Director of Communications for the organization. Today, I'm really excited to have Tom Keir on the show. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. Tom is heavily involved in the outdoor industry. He's an outdoor writer, a regular contributor to the Rough Grouse Society magazine, and he's also a very experienced grouse and woodcock hunter. And so today, we're going to be talking about why we love grouse hunting so much. I want to kind of explore with Tom some of his famous old grouse hunting literature, and also explore some issues regarding how we think we can overcome any perceived barrier or overcoming the challenge that people think about when they think about getting into grouse hunting. Figure out some more ways we can get more folks involved in a grouse and woodcock hunting. For listeners that may not know, maybe you can kind of fill us in a little bit on your background and what you do.
My wife and I have our own company called The Keir Group, which is a branding, marketing, advertising, and public relations company. We specialize in working with vertical markets and in particular the fish hunt industry. We do a little bit with equestrian, some with boating, but our main focus is working in a collaborative way to help strengthen the businesses, whether it's a manufacturer or a travel destination venue, to be profitable and for more customers to be aware of them so that they can in turn contribute to helping our legacy of fishing and hunting. And they're huge proponents of the active outdoor sports, and it's a pleasure to work with them.
I know you do a lot of fishing for different species, a lot of hunting for different species, but I'm sure that grouse and woodcock hunting is your favorite.
Without question. If I had to pick everything that we do and rank it, grouse and woodcock with dogs would be number one.
I mentioned earlier that you've been a longtime contributor to the RGS magazine. You do a lot of outdoor writing for various publications. How did you get into writing? I know I like your stuff, and a lot of other folks do too, and it'd be interesting to know how you got into it in the first place.
Well, first off, thanks for the compliment. I have about 650 rejection letters that I'm saving to wallpaper a room with, so any compliment is more than appreciated. I got started writing through reading. I was an avid reader as a boy, played a lot of sports, and then obviously fished and hunted, but I loved to read. And the more I read, the more I said to myself, you know, I wonder if I could write. And I started off writing, basic journal entries when I was a teenager and tried my hand at poetry and failed miserably. And then started writing outdoor and short literary fiction. I love to write literary short stories and have just had a tremendous career writing outdoor pieces.
I enjoy writing too, and without getting into the theories and the specifics on how to go about writing an article, are there certain types of stories that you like to write about? Do you like to write first-person stories about yourself or fiction or anything like that?
My favorite would have to be a narrative essay, because there's a point to it and there's also a little latitude to meander. I do a lot of gear reviews, do a lot of destination reviews, a lot of how-tos, some destination pieces, but the narrative essay would have to be my favorite.
For us, you've written a lot of grouse and woodcock specific articles, some sort of days gone by articles, things like that. Do you enjoy writing about old-time grouse hunting stories, and if so, why?
It has to do with tradition and legacy. And if we're not careful, tradition and legacy can slide away from us. My kids are teenagers. My wife loves to hunt. It's something that we've been doing for a long time, individually as well as collectively. And there is such a rich tradition in grouse and woodcock hunting that if we can keep it alive, to pay homage to those who came before us, to look at what they did right, look at what they did wrong, we'll be better stewards of the land, we'll be better educators for our subsequent generations, and we'll be able to connect with the past. When I read Gorham Cross's Partridge Shortening, which was originally published as a 100-volume run that was passed out to his friends. He's writing about the days in upstate New York, and he later moved to Wellesley, Massachusetts. It was the golden days of grouse hunting right when we were moving from the agrarian society into the industrial society. And counted in one of his pieces that he and Tap Tapley and Lennox, John Lennox Putnam's dad, I can't remember his first name, but they limited out on grouse in 2 hours, shot their four-bird limit, 12 birds, and continued to flush birds all day. When I went through to try and count the number of birds that they saw during that hunt, and it was 103. I've never seen 103 birds in an outing.
That's crazy.
Let alone a 6 or 7 hour hunting day. That said, there's a lot of wisdom in that time that we can extrapolate from and use as conservation or preservation tactics. It sets the bar for what we aspire to, and it helps us to figure out what did they do right that we could be doing a better job of.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you're talking about some of those old, you know, the old famous grouse books that carries on the grouse hunting tradition, not only are they good stories, I mean, they're fun to read and it's good to hear about the history and things like that, but a lot of them actually also were written with a message. I tend to believe something that these writers wanted to portray to continue those traditions in the future. Do you see the same thing?
I sure do, and I see that in the direction that your magazine has taken since you've been on board, which is a nod to the past and a way to use the past as a form of education for the future. You know, when I look at a book like Woodcock Shooting, which was written, it was Edmund Davis's book, and he was originally from Providence, Rhode Island, and it was written in the turn of the 20th century, it was about 1903, I think, 1904. And he was one of the first true woodcock hunters in New Brunswick, Canada. And he is credited as being one of the first bird hunters, not just to go up there, but to use a bird dog. He created different clothing that would withstand any of the briars or the thick cover. He's credited with using a bell on the dog to find, you know, to be in close contact and know where the dog is. He's credited with running setters and focusing on the lineage so as to help breed better quality dogs. He obviously was moving the same. I counted his woodcock days, and he's got some interesting charts in there of 100 bird days. So it's fascinating to read books that focus on not just the golden era, but also the pioneers, the folks that were really learning how to do it at a time when not many folks had done it. And, you know, there's some of Gene Hill's work, Frank Woolner, who was from Massachusetts. He was a former editor of Saltwater Sportsman. But these are the guys that were doing it before it was popular, before it was common. And what's interesting, too, is that at the turn of the century, you know, the early 1900s, it's the Roosevelt era, so a lot of the hunters were traveling, so that was nothing new. But they were pursuing more big game, particularly out west, whether it was grizzly bears in Alaska or elk or mule deer in Montana and Colorado, African game. But there really wasn't a focus on grouse and woodcock as a viable game to pursue. And that's what makes those guys interesting, because they were just a little bit different from what the regular trend was.
To me, they were sort of visionaries, and their writing is, in a lot of ways, respected more now than it was when it first came out, for many reasons. They obviously saw some great numbers and had some great hunts, something that we're not seeing now to that certain extent, and it's fun to read about that stuff. But they were visionaries in other ways. I mean, there's certain messages in their stories that go along the lines of preserving sporting traditions and the importance of creating habitat and things. It's almost like you can feel their passion and you understand that that's what they meant. They meant to spread that message. Do you agree with that?
I do. And, you know, if you take a look at another Massachusetts fella, William Harnden Foster, who wrote New England Grouse Shooting, invented skeet, you know, you're exactly right.
With a lot of those guys that you mentioned and you know, a lot of the other great classic grouse and woodcock hunting books. What's, if I can put you on the spot, what's your favorite and why?
That's an excellent question. I don't know that I have a single favorite. I think it depends on my mood and probably time of year. And as I've gotten older, probably my age, I think that, you know, when I was younger, I tended to like Woolner's books because they were very how-to and very factual, and it helped me fast-track my growth curve. So Woolner was always talking about short barrels on guns and light loads and open chokes, and I found that that was helpful with my own shooting. But as I age, I tend to like a little bit more the essay format, because the grouse and woodcock literature, as you had mentioned earlier, Matt, is just so rich in texture. It's certainly about going into the woods, pursuing game and wanting to shoot birds, but it's not so much about filling the freezer as it is about shooting a bird, you know, for the sake of your dog that has been casting back and forth and ultimately found the bird and pointed the bird, and it's done its job, and, you know, your job is to bring down the bird. So I think that there's that rich texture and emotion. It's about life, you know. When I read Corey Ford's any of the lower 40 stories, Road to Tinkham Town, you know, it's about life itself, and bird hunting is just the vehicle. It's the friends that we have, it's the dogs that we've had, it's the successes and the failures. It's never about bag counts or high volume shooting like you see in some of the hunting experiences in South America for dove or ducks, or, you know, any of the driven shoots in England or Hungary, you know, for high pheasant or grouse. But it's about quality, and it's about connecting with folks.
I kind of want to switch gears a little bit and talk about your writing specifically. You had written an article for the fall issue of RGS magazine called The Lost Covert. It seems like it was a personal experience of yours, an area where there was some great grouse and woodcock hunting, but because of some changes in the way things happened, that it ended up going away, unfortunately. I've received a lot of great comments from folks saying they could relate to that specific story, and also to the fact that there was an underlying message in there that's something that we need to try to avoid. If you don't mind, could you kind of fill us in on that story, how that came about, and how you ended up putting pen to paper?
I think the story got started about 20 years ago, and it got started in reading some of Bert Spiller's work. I think that it came about when I got into my car at the time, and 20 years ago, as everybody remembers, is pre-digital. And, you know, I kept reading the fact that he lived in East Rochester, New Hampshire. I said, well, you know, I hunt New Hampshire, and a lot of the places that I hunt were hunted by Woolner and Tapley and Gorham Cross and stuff like that. And I got in my car and I drove up to see what East Rochester was like, thinking, you know, maybe I could find a couple new covers. And all I found was asphalt and concrete, big box stores and shopping malls. And so that's probably where it began. And as urban sprawl continued and continues today, we see a loss of habitat. And every year, there's one or two covers that we'll lose because the landowner who graciously allowed us to hunt his or her property has passed away. And, you know, some new folks come in and they're not supportive of hunting, or they don't understand conservation, and they certainly don't understand selective or clear cutting as part of building a healthy ecosystem and a healthy forest, not just for grouse and woodcock, but for other animals, other birds and rabbits and squirrels, etc. And that one particular property was owned by a woman and her late husband who were from Pennsylvania, and they spent the summers up in New Hampshire. And it was my favorite cover, this classic hillside on one part, and in the flat behind the house, it was just alder and popple with a few seeps and just classic woodcock cover. It was, as we started our conversation, it was traditional, it was classic. There was primary and secondary growth. There were some regular logging practices, which came about mostly because of their need for wood for the winter. There was a part of that story that I didn't cover, which is I actually met the folks and had lunch with them by accident with a mutual friend. And when I asked them why they cut the whole cover down, they said, well, there were a bunch of hunters that actually come in here and they shoot all the birds. She was talking about me. I said, well, you know, maybe some of them are good shots and maybe others of them are not so good shots. So maybe you hear the gunfire, but they're not shooting all the birds. But what was your reason for cutting everything down? And she said, well, it was to preserve the birds. And as we all know, grouse and woodcock don't spend a whole lot of time in fields. But to her mind, she really thought that she was doing everyone a service. She thought she was being a good steward of the land. She thought that she was protecting the birds. When actually, while we may have shot, you know, half a dozen woodcock and a couple of grouse, you know, per year, she cut down all the nesting, the breeding, the pass-through, you know, just she cut down everything. So there was a 0% return on the bird population by the time that she and her husband got through with it. It's, if we aren't vigilant to that, to protecting open space, working on conservation versus preservation, we'll lose more. And it's something that I think that for any of us who enjoy grouse and woodcock hunting, we have to be sensitive to, particularly when it comes to legacy and wanting to leave hunting areas for our kids.
So it's that misunderstanding that we're trying to overcome through education and many of the things that we're doing here at the Rough Grouse Society, including the messaging that's in the magazine. And hopefully articles like this can kind of help do that, educate folks on really the science behind the things that we do for the birds. So I want to thank you for that. Now, like I mentioned before, you're an avid grouse and woodcock hunter. You've had a lot of years of experience in hunting and spotting covers. You know what good versus poor habitat is for finding birds. And we've talked about you contributing an article to a future RGS magazine about that exact thing, helping folks maybe that are new hunters, make it maybe a little easier for them to spot covers when they're going out next fall. Can you maybe, if you don't mind, give me a little precursor on what that article might be about and what folks could expect in the next magazine?
The best way, and where I've had the greatest success, is from reading your magazine, because I can learn a lot more about the actual ecosystem and how it functions, as opposed to walking through the woods and trying to figure it out on my own. And you guys always, with all of your research and all of your publications, have always helped me to understand the environment and where I'm going to find birds. In an ideal world, I would love to spend a week or two with a biologist and a forest or two and go through and put those, because that's where the twain shall meet, with the birds as well as the ecology. The whole is the sum of the parts. And for this piece, I'm looking at it a little bit differently. Most folks really want to just understand what are the trees, what are the berries, where are the birds, what do I look for? And that's easy to punch out, and it winds up being a real logical piece, easily illustrated with pictures of trees and leaves and etc. But I'm looking at it from a little bit, and I took some direction from the way that you all approach the business of conservation and birds, which is to look at what is the sum that results in the whole. How do we go from a drumming log, for instance, into where the birds ultimately wind up? Most people just want to know where the birds are in October and November, and they want to go there and say, aha, this is where I should go. But I'm looking at it from the breeding cycle and the birds pushing out after nesting. Should there be some water? What kind of fruit, you know, and berries are they looking for? What time of year does that come? If you're looking at something like beech nuts, you know, and you're not focusing on when they're on the ground, you're not going to find grouse there. You'll find lots of beech trees and you'll find lots of nuts, but you're not going to find the grouse because the nuts aren't on the ground. So it's kind of looking at how the whole process goes from drumming log into fall and winter habitat, with the prime time being fall and winter.
You know, through the magazine, it helps us, in a way, overcome the perceived possible entry barrier that some believe there is in place, the entry barrier to getting into grouse and woodcock hunting. And that's something we want to try to overcome. And that's the last topic I kind of want to just cover with you. Do you see or believe in any perceived entry barrier to grouse and woodcock hunting? And if so, do you have any theories or thoughts on how you might overcome that?
I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I think that people were a lot tougher several decades ago, pre-technology. I think that they spent a lot more time outside. I think that they were used to rolling down windows instead of pushing a button and having a window roll down. And I think that grouse and woodcock hunting, which is challenging, as you know, is something that was kind of more normal. Nowadays, I think that America's youth, and I see it with our own kids, you know, we really have to make a concerted effort to get them outside because theirs is a digital world. But they can't get the pleasure of running a dog or seeing a dog go on point or learning to navigate through the woods. So I think that we need to be a little bit more patient with kids. We need to give them more opportunities. I think that making them, and what I like about grouse and woodcock hunting is that it's so process-oriented and that there's so much for everyone. You know, for the person, for those who like gear, there's gear. For those who like dogs, the sky's the limit. For those who like terrain and just being in, you know, some of the most beautiful places around, that's a grouse and woodcock wood. We just need to give them the opportunity and to be good shepherds and to take them out, maybe breaking a hunt down into smaller parcels, maybe taking more frequent breaks, helping them to, you know, taking a break and explaining flora and fauna, taking a break and examining the bird and looking at frayed wingtips on a woodcock or determining the gender of the woodcock with a dollar bill or cleaning the crop of a grouse or, you know, really looking at nature and how it unfolds, navigating, you know, learning. That's a great skill for kids to learn because a lot of times in the places that we go, you don't get cell reception, so you cannot use a GPS. You know, you have to do it the old way with a topo map and a compass. And the thing that binds us as a family, I think that it's something that I know my daughter's brought some of her friends out, and they're not fearful of it. They look at it as exciting, and they look at it as interesting, and they look at it as something that is so very different to their normal everyday sit in front of a screen world.
It's good to hear success stories like that where kids, youth are getting involved. It's sort of the next generation of grouse hunters, so to speak, which is necessary and something that we definitely here at the Rough Grouse Society understand that we need to increase new hunters, increase youth numbers, and get that next generation going too. So, Tom, I want to thank you for your time. That's about all the time we have for today. But from the grouse tradition talk, you know, the old literature and also the youth initiatives, that's a lot of good information. So, one last question. If somebody wants to get a hold of you to talk outdoors or outdoor writing or anything, what would be the best way to do that?
They can check out our website, which is the Keer Group, thekeergroup.com or tomkeer.com. My email is tom@thekeergroup. We're located on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and I love chatting about fishing and hunting and, you know, as I mentioned earlier, grouse and woodcock is something that I drop everything to talk about.
Great stuff once again, Tom. I appreciate it.
Matt, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Drummer Podcast from the Ruffed Grouse Society in association with the American Woodcock Society. Find out more at ruffedgrousesociety.org.